Welcome to The Steer, the show where we talk to writers about music and musicians about books. Hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Joshua James Amberson. Hey, just a quick note before we begin. This episode is with Andre Perry, the author of Some of Us Are Very Hungry Now, a personal essay collection about music and race in America. And Andre just wanted us to give a warning before we get going that the reading he begins the show with references racial slurs in the context of white people listening to black music. If this is something you don't want to hear, skip ahead to around the 13-minute mark. This episode was recorded a few months ago when Andre was on his book tour and came through Portland. And the first half of the season was recorded over the course of the last 8 months. We recorded it, these episodes thinking that they wouldn't date themselves very much or show many signs of having been recorded in the recent past, not knowing how much the world would change. So if you're curious why none of these interviews reference COVID or the global protests that erupted over the murder of George Floyd, or why authors and musicians are moving freely around the country on tours, that's why. They're from the very recent past. The second half of the season, which will hopefully begin in a couple months, will be all recently recorded. In the meantime, enjoy this episode with Andre Perry.
Joshua.
Jeff.
How are you?
Well, you?
I'm good. My dog hurt his hoof, his left hoof, Ooh. So I have to go to the vet. But other than that, I'm well. But he's 12 and a half.
Oh,
so
yeah.
A laceration on a hoof can be, you know, he's just like, I'm good, but he's just hobbling around on three legs.
Aww.
And it's kind of sad, but also he wants to go out. And, you know, with the weather, you don't want to coop up your dog all the time because it's so rainy. But then he's going to have to get the cone of shame, mm-hmm. you know, because he will not stop licking it.
Yeah.
I've been Epsom salting it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we go to the vet this afternoon and I'm just telling you that they're going to say, and then he's going to hate it. When he was young, he tried to chew through the cone of shame and he made pretty good headway.
Oh,
it's like plastic. And then he defecated plastic and it was foul.
Oh, that is foul.
But I'm doing well.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that. Yeah.
Thank you. Andre Perry.
Andre Perry. Yeah.
Tell me about your relationship with Andre Perry.
Well, I just read about his essay collection a couple months ago, and it was on $2 Radio, it's a press I really like, and and it just sounded good, and so I've been reading it, and just brought him up to you as a possibility for having him on the show, because I thought, you know, he talks, kind of lives between those worlds of writing and music. So I kind of thought
he was a musician.
A musician, played in bands, still plays in bands. And so, I thought it would be a great fit. And last night I went and saw him at Powell's with Anis Mogiani.
Mogiani, yeah.
And who's a great local poet and
International poet who lives locally.
Yeah, we should say that. Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah, he does live like, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah. And they were in conversation at Powell's last night, and it was great. I mean, both of them had so many interesting things to say, and Andre just had such a great perspective on everything, and they fielded, they had audience Q&A, which, you know, as you know, can go awry. Mm-hmm. And this one, in conversation, I would say that this went awry, because people asked some real weird questions or non-questions, and they just fielded them. Both of them did a great job, but maybe Andre especially just really just not flinching and mm-hmm. answering these oddball questions really deeply and well, and it making them seem like as if they were good questions. Yeah, there was an older gentleman who was like, "You guys are young," and they're like, "Well, kind of. We're
Yeah,
like
Anise,
40,
yeah,
you know."
Anise is like 42, I think.
Yeah, and
Andre's 41 or so. I mean,
I think
they're
so.
youngish,
Yeah.
but we're, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this guy was 80 or something, you know,
Oh,
so I
really?
mean, like,
Yeah.
comparatively, yeah, they're half his age. But they're just kind of like, yeah, and it's like, what do you think about technology?
Oh, really?
Yeah,
So it has nothing to do with their books.
nothing to
That's
do.
great.
Yeah. And they just went with it,
They
yeah.
handled it.
And yeah, and there was another wild woman in the front row who was making a lot of sounds during it, and not even during the Q&A. She brought up how what they're saying reminded her of a scene in Pretty Woman, and which
Huh.
seemed completely disconnected to everyone else, but Anise and Andre were able to make the connection and really see it, and it was impressive. Yeah,
That
it
sounds
was
impressive.
I was yeah, I was like, I've never seen two people. Oh, and when I mentioned it to Andre, he was like, it's a community event. You just have to kind of, you know, respond to what the people bring. And I thought that was just a really great
Well,
perspective.
yeah, and I mean, this is his first book, so some of us are very hungry now. But he co-founded the Mission Creek, what's the technical title? The Mission Creek Arts and Literature Music Festival,
Which you go to often, right?
which I go to, yeah, because I lived in Nebraska for years. One of my close friends, so I have close friends who live in Iowa City, so I've gone 4 years in a row, and I. It's been around for like 13, 14 plus years, maybe even more than that. But I guess what I'm trying to say is he's comfortable in front of an audience, but he's also comfortable, I think, harnessing oddball questions and
Yeah.
massaging them into something that's maybe on topic. Because I have seen him, I actually haven't seen him read in Iowa City, but I have seen him like introduce things and kind of be a moderator, I guess, because he co-founded it, so he's running around all weekend.
Yeah.
And frankly, I've been in similar situations, and I can be very stressed. And like, he seems to have a calmness about him. So maybe weird questions at pals are kind of the least of the stuff that he's handled.
That's probably true, yeah.
And that book is great. Yeah. Some of Us Are Very Hungry Now, which is his first debut kind of essay collection, which has gotten a lot of acclaim. Yeah. All right. This is Andre Perry.
Dear Emma, I was in Iowa City in the Student Union for a concert, and I was surrounded by over 1,800 white people. I was alone. I was the smallest black man in the world. Outside, the air was warm and dry. Summer had yet to touch down with its fever heat and thick humidity. Inside, the body steamed up the room. Everyone looked so young. I stood near the back where the congestion thinned out. Up front, it was wild, the students fervent in their adoration, their devotion to the man on stage, Kendrick Lamar. He had rolled on to the platform, dressed in a black crew neck sweatshirt, charcoal jeans, and white high tops. He wore a Yankees hat with the New York logo surrounded by two hashtags. He looked down at us from the stage and asked, "What the hell am I doing in Iowa?" The students erupted. Their rolling arms, bent legs, and hunched bodies all resembled so well the clips they had seen on YouTube. Most everyone knew the lyrics to the songs, and many people sang them aloud. At certain moments, the interplay between artist and audience elevated to a call and response. Kendrick bounced around the stage, singing and shouting his songs, smiling at the floor of students in front of him. When his song finished, the kids stood up tall, with their hands in the air, looking like corn crop in late summer, ready for picking, ready for consumption. I was enthralled, less with Kendrick and more with the scene. I marveled at how the deeply considered music of a black man from Los Angeles could resonate so vigorously with the white student body from Chicagoland and Iowa. I wanted to understand how much of what he meant by his words had possibly been lost or actively discarded in translation. I wanted to understand why an album, Good Kid, Mad City, that I felt so connected to on headphones, now seemed like it was several acres away, with the divide of college students between me and the artist on stage. I was getting queasy. My hands were sweating and my face turned hot, and I didn't quite understand why. I inched back slowly with each song, getting closer to the venue's exit. The beat from Mad City dropped in like a series of disorienting thunderclaps. It was shocking. It was amazing. Something detonated in the students around me. They left their feet, their eyes glossed over with fascination. The opening hook unfolded, and I sensed immediately there would be a problem. As Kendrick sang, "Man down, where you from, nigga?" and the ensuing lines all ended with a declaration of the N-word, it seemed as if the entire room chimed in, shouting along with genuine enthusiasm. The roar of almost 2,000 white people shouting nigga in a room with a black man on stage took on an odd quality, like a twisted reshaping of a rally of nationalists and fascists. I looked around me, peering at the enthusiastic youth, and felt almost entirely alone, separated from my music, my blues, my town, my identity. Kendrick beamed on stage, energized by the power, the taut grip of his music. I backed out of the concert hall more intently than before. I walked outside where it was warm, quiet, and entirely serene. I wondered, is this the legacy rap has left us with? Do these students understand the blues that run so deeply in Kendrick's songs? Do they understand that these are work songs, God songs, gospels, redemptions, as much as they are anthems for parties with kegs and cocaine and university-branded sweatshirts? In the faraway future, when they, the people who have survived humanity's current savagery, look back at our culture and study our music, what will they call rap? Will they call it by that name, or will 100 years from blues to jazz to rap come to be understood as one insistent call from a tired but endlessly resilient and expressive people? Will they simply call it Americana? Will they understand that the more pain we faced, the more creative we became, that our music of emotional slavery was not just a series of notes and figures and rhythms, that when we said slavery, we didn't just mean ours, we meant yours too, that when we wrote songs, they were more than songs, they were the text of American history itself. Kendrick, Lady Day, Howling Wolf. These songs are civil wars, are emancipations, are movements for deferred liberties, are the sorrows of systematic isolation, and are the joys of understanding that a fractured life is still life nonetheless. So when we sing this Americana songbook, we should be awake and know that when we sing someone else's song, we are also singing our own. My head was full of confusion, as it often is. I briefly considered seeking solace in the bar, in glasses of whiskey and beer, always my easiest escape. But my compass endured, and I climbed the hill toward my home, toward you. I knew I would find warmth by your side. It is a place I go when I've been left alone or stumbled by my own stupid actions. I fall into your arms, as I always do, as I always will. Your skin is as pale as mine is dark, and in that way, we are America too.
All right. Andre Perry, thank you.
Indeed.
What is the title of that essay?
That's called Americana, Dying of Thirst.
Dying of Thirst. How long have you lived in Iowa City at this point?
I've lived in Iowa City for almost 15 years.
Oh, so you've been there, okay, a while.
Yes, I moved there in 2005.
2005, you started the MFA?
I did. I was in school for 3 years, and then I was teaching for a year, and then I worked for the university for another year. So I had like 5 years of the University of Iowa.
Right. Now, have you read from this there?
Yes, I have. When this book came out, I did two readings in Iowa. I did one in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It was my first reading, which is this slightly more industrial town just north of Iowa City.
Uh-huh.
And then I did a reading in Iowa City, and I actually did read that because I wanted to read a bunch of the Iowa stuff in Iowa.
So at Prairie Lights?
It was at Prairie Lights, yeah.
So how has it been taken? I mean, because you're not anti. I mean, I guess I don't live in Iowa City. I've been there. I guess you're honest. I don't know. Have people been like, I don't know. How's it been taken in Iowa City, which is a very small, well, it's not very small, but I mean, it's an oasis of a certain sort, within the larger Midwest, I guess.
Yeah. I think it's been taken okay. And if it's not being taken well, I don't think the people who are not taking it well have been in direct contact with me. So maybe I've been sheltered from it, but I think there's on the surface it might seem like there's some deep criticism of the community there that pops up maybe in the piece I just read, as well as, you know, maybe some other parts of the book. But I think they're more just trying to be honest reflections of how complex our communities can be, whether they're in Iowa or the Pacific Northwest or in the East Coast, where we have an abundance of great things and beautiful people and good culture. And then we also have these difficult issues, often race and class and gender and sexuality, that we're also wrestling with at the same time. And it's not that any town is perfect or any town is like the worst. It's just like there's a lot of things going on. And I think the book was a challenge to myself and to us more generally to just like interrogate the complexity with which in we live.
So, I mean, and you know, is this paradox of all these people at this Kendrick Lamar show? I mean, that probably wasn't the first time that you had realized that. I mean, that all of these people idolize Kendrick Lamar in this instance, are saying this word. But was it like the presentness of that kind of that was so, I mean, versus listening on headphones, I guess, listening it kind of in that, you know, implicitly, I mean, that so many kind of suburban kids versus seeing it with 1800 people there.
Yeah. It was not a surprise to me that there are white kids listening to rap music who are singing along to it, you know, repeating words that I don't know if are necessarily words they should be repeating as they listen to it. So like that was not a surprise to me, you know.
Right.
I grew up in America and been listening to rap since rap was available for me to listen to. So it's more just like you have these moments where you've had feelings and you've like maybe been processing things like low level in the back of your brain, but it like a really particular physical moment can like just bring it all together for you. And not that was the only one, but just that essay of being at that Kendrick concert was definitely one of those moments where you're like, what, like the system has failed us, right? You know, mm-hmm. We're at a place of higher education, arguably the best university or, you know, college in the state of Iowa. You know, it's famous for lots of things for its undergraduate and graduate programs.
Right.
So it's like a place of higher learning.
It's
and we're sitting in a
very
room.
Noted place of higher learning,
you know?
Right?
And we're sitting in a room with someone who's like really like a really deeply considered and like thoughtful musician and artist who in that particular record would, you know, is just a great just work of just like narrative rap. And like, where are we that like thousands of kids are like either oblivious or just going past the tension that they're like, you know, using this word that is just like certainly they shouldn't be using, and to not understand like the irony or the offense of like being in a room and like shouting that all together. And so I just stepped back and I was like where did, like what's up with the how, we're not constructing this well, you know?
We're not constructing this.
And it wasn't as much of an anger as you know, I would say just like a shock that we need to do better collectively.
Obviously, you're not Kendrick Lamar, but that's probably something that he faces every night, right?
Yeah. After that show that happened in Iowa, there's a show, I can't remember which town it's in, but it's captured on YouTube, and it's in like a much bigger arena. I mean, it's like a show, like mm-hmm. thousands and thousands of people. And he invites a lady on stage who is young, I believe, and white, mm-hmm. and they're actually singing the same song. And he's doing like a sing-along, and she says the M-word while they're singing, and he's like, whoa, like stop the beat, DJ. You
whoa.
Know, like, so they have to like stop in the middle of the show, and he's like, hey, he's basically like, yo, like, I just need you to like to not say that word, so like, let's try again.
Wow.
Which.
And that kind of made news, right? Because
yeah,
I
it was
remember
like
reading about that.
Viral.
Yeah.
And I think he was like really like kind about it, and like maybe kinder than he needed to be. But he definitely wasn't like trying to go out and play a show and have to have like a teachable moment like in the middle of his like show in whatever town it was in. But I don't know, it was intense, you know. Like I can't imagine having been there, having been her, having been Kendrick, being in like anyone. Like it just was really intense. But at the same time, like maybe a good moment.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, for me reading this, there's like, I'm just on page 52 in American Gray Space. Does this white college grad consider the image of the African-American portrayed in hip hop when considering larger racial issues? Does he even care to mix his art with politics and ethics? Maybe after all, it's just music and the ethos of rock and roll filtered through the American experience comes out in such a way that N-words or homies or bros or pals or dudes are your crew. And I mean, I think growing up listening to a lot of hip hop, I mean, I'm from Northern Nevada. Yeah, you know, it's me just, I don't want to mix politics and ethics. I just want to have a good time. But also there's the irony that you can't really necessarily have that. You have to, if you want to be an active listener and kind of take these considerations into account, you have to think through those things. And I mean, I think as a white college grad, I mean, this book made me think a lot, you know, and I mean about what I shy away from, but what also is necessary for me to consider, you know, as I get older, especially because this stuff is, for me at least, I think for a lot of white people, it's tough to talk about. We just keep in these same systemic kind of ways of thinking.
That's for real. And it, yes, we need to have fun as humans, but American music is music. It's can sometimes be pop, it can sometimes be avant-garde, but it is very often also like a text for American history, where we've been and where we are as a culture. And so even something that's just like, oh, like that beat is like sick, is also like telling the story of like who we are in some way. And in particular, a lot of the work that someone like Kendrick has done, as well as many other rappers, as well as many like rock musicians. It's like, we just have to remember that there's also this like responsibility that comes with like listening to the music. It's really reflecting some of the painful and sometimes the joyous things that we've gone through as a collective people and continue to go through in this country. There've been some young people in some of the crowds, though I would like to engage more with like someone who's like a student at, you know, Iowa or like Reed or whatever. Reed, and like someone who's like 20 now, you know, and to get their perspective, you know, all of us might be just like a little bit older and kind of like just had the benefit of some more years on us to like really reflect on life. But I'd like to get the perspective of someone who's like, I guess even younger than a millennial, you know, at this point, around some of these issues around just music, race, culture. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, all of this book isn't about hip hop either. I mean, these are personal essays. I mean, obviously we've talked about Kendrick Lamar, but I mean, we're gonna listen to some. You're not somebody who only listens to hip hop. I mean, you run the gamut. Now, how long did this take to write? I mean, was this over like 10 years?
Yeah,
it seems like it kind of explores a lot of different sides or kind of eras of yourself.
Yeah, I think the thrust of the book really finds me like 15 to 20 years ago. It's like the character in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And about half of the essays developed over a really long period. You know, I started experimenting with some of these things, like some of the ideas here when I was in school. And then, you know, those years after school, and about half the essays appeared in literary journals or other forms, like a much, you know, kind of like earlier proto versions of themselves. And it was a few years ago when I sat down and started to see that there might be a shape for some of these ideas in a kind of more focused piece or focused collection. And that's when I got to the work of like trying to figure out what the shape of a manuscript might look like, and wrote some new stuff, rewrote some old stuff, got a first draft done. And then after really soliciting some super helpful feedback, I was able to go back and then, you know, strip away more, add more and revise more and get it to the close to the form that it's in today. So it was a process. I think those early essays that were in much more skeletal versions were like that first attempt to start like scratching at some of these issues. And I do think time and just like getting older, hopefully more mature to some extent, helped me really tease out, I think, some of the more complex, multi-layered issues of how we help or hurt each other on a daily basis.
Yeah. How we help or hurt each other. Now, I mean, a lot of the, yeah, because a lot of the book is about not writing, or about writing to a degree and not being necessarily happy with what you wrote. Were you in periods, though, for years when you were like, had ideas that weren't really coming to fruition?
I think that's all writers.
Well, yeah, that's a good answer.
Absolutely, yeah. Actually, every single one.
But I mean, are you, what type of writer are you? Were for years, were you working every day, or do you go in kind of, you write for 2 weeks and then you take some time off? I mean, are you a daily type of writer? Because you do a lot of other stuff, right?
Yeah. I think it's always changing as my life changes. Though right now, I'm very much, I try to be a daily writer because my schedule demands it, and I'm spiritually, I think that's where I'm at. I try to write every morning for anywhere between 30 to 90 minutes.
So a while.
And I just do it 5 days a week, take the weekend off, and it's just like a discipline, mm-hmm. working out. You know, it's just a thing I do. And that repetition is really good for me because it means I'm always thinking about the material, right? Even when I'm not writing, I'm just like at like downtime or something, grabbing coffee or whatever. So it's like always just kind of active in my mind. Before that, I used to, I think, be in that more like classic version of, you know, like writing for like 8 hours a day or 6 hours a day or whatever, and just being devoted to that writer's lifestyle. But I think I was afforded that privilege more so when I was in graduate school, which is many years ago now, just because like you have time, right? And you've like actively decided to like take time away from like your regular work and your regular job and life. So that was great. Probably the most difficult time was in between those two, which is that period where if you've had the privilege of going to a graduate program, then leaving that graduate program and figuring out how do you create a writing lifestyle that involves doing your work, like your discipline of writing, finding some other work so that you can pay rent, and then like having a nurturing writing community that maybe stuck around or maybe just dispersed to like a million different places around the globe, and you're like all of a sudden like all alone. Mm-hmm. And so just like finding the right balance of those things. I don't think I did that as well as I could have, but you know, I'm not complaining. So it just took me a minute to kind of get onto this like more disciplined track. I also have a daughter. And so like when you have a kid like that,
right,
like really starts to like lock in your schedule for me in a good way. Cause you're like, this is just the time I got to write, you yeah. know, like, and you're just
well,
like, cool.
You don't have the luxury.
Yeah. I don't have to think about it. Right. You know, I just do it. Mm-hmm.
Well, when you say you didn't, did you think about leaving Iowa City? Because I mean, part of this, I think Ethan is the. Did you use, are they pseudonyms in a lot of places or in some places?
For the most part, these are these people are not going by the names that they go by in daily life.
Well, I mean, I want to kind of get to San Francisco, but did you think strongly about leaving Iowa City, like your Ethan, right? Ethan in the book, who's the actor?
He's the director.
Yeah. I mean, who does in the essay?
No Country.
Yeah.
Did I think about? Yeah, definitely thought about leaving Iowa City. I mean, when I moved there, my sense was that I'd be there for a couple years or 3 years, and then probably move back to the Bay Area, and if not doing that, move to New York. And after I graduated, I ended up being able to work at the university for a couple years, and it was just nice to have that opportunity, and the market was crashing around that time. And so
the academic job market, or
I mean, that was a recession,
yeah,
including the academic job market. And so I think that series of events had me recalculate how I might apply my time and where I might be geographically. Also, you know, I work doing a lot of programming and community events, and you know, was involved in the Mission Creek Festival project, and that led to other things. And that work was really rewarding, being able to work with musicians, work with writers, work with other artists. And so I really put my head down into that as well. It's kind of like my parallel work that I was doing in the world. And I think through that, I started to develop basically what my, at least my mission is in this stage of my life, which is to both be creating art, but also to develop support systems for other artists, whether it's through programming or residencies or some other outlet. And so Iowa City just turned out to be a good place to do that. And I think there are plenty of good places, but that one was good for me, mm-hmm. or has been good for me.
I know, Jeff, you've been to the Mission Creek Festival, but I have only have read about it, but maybe tell us a little about what that is or how that got started.
Yeah, for sure. So the original Mission Creek Music and Arts Festival was in the Bay Area. It's founded by this guy, Jeff Ray, also from the DC area where I grew up. And he started it as this this festival in San Francisco that really gave a platform to, I think, more underground art, not necessarily in competition or against the other events that are happening, but just to kind of fill out the scene a little bit. And so it featured a lot of great musicians, some installation and visual artists, and some of the writing scene. And I ended up working for him when I was living in San Francisco. And then when I moved to Iowa, he, you know, put up the idea of like, maybe we create a parallel event in the Midwest. And so with a good friend of mine out there, this guy, Tanner Illingworth, we all collaborated, the three of us, and we started the Mission Creek Fest out there as a celebration of music and literature. And the focus really remains on just like independent voices in both the music and lit scenes, and just like finding a way to like create community and just like have a positive space for those folks to go. Since we started that a long time ago, it's coming up on year 15 this April. Yeah.
Wait, in San Francisco or in Iowa?
In Iowa.
Oh, it's been around. So it's been. Oh, I didn't realize it was that long. Okay.
First one was 2006.
Wow. Okay, and you were because you co-founded. So you were you've been spearheading it from the get-go.
Yes, I've been involved from the top. And there've been a lot of just amazing folks who've been involved and just built it along the way. It started out very DIY. It's a little, we got to the point where we've been kind of institutionalizing
it's legit.
It's hitting year 15. And at this point, we're just all about intimacy, you know, because the festival market has exploded, particularly for music, but for other forms as well. And it's like, we just want to be that space where you go into like a small club. You maybe see an artist who you love or you've never seen before, and you just get back to that moment where you were in the basement or the first time you, like, your friends like got you into like the DIY venue or the rock club in your town, and you just like have that just like totally innocent experience with music. So that's kind of where we're at, and really blurring and crossing the lines between writers and musicians who we think are just, I mean, all artists are awesome, but just like sometimes writers, in my opinion, I feel like we're like on this like kind of like orbit around like all the other people making art. And it's like, oh no, we're artists too. And like, and we need to be in conversation with these people because all of our work's only going to get better and our understanding of what we're doing is only going to get better. So,
sure. I mean, you're a musician.
Yeah, I do play music too.
Well, because in the San Francisco essay, I mean, you lived with your band.
Yeah.
So what type of music did you guys play? Or what was it like? I mean, because were you in several bands?
I was in several bands. In the book, when I talk about living with my friends, that was this band called The Cuffs.
The Cuffs.
That was this kind of...
C-U-F-F-S?
K-U-F-F-S.
Okay. All right.
It was kind of like a space rock band, I think. Right.
Can we find that on YouTube? Like, I mean, is it something that's still in the world?
It's in the world. It's like pre-YouTube. I mean, it's literally pre-YouTube before created. Yeah. But there are probably some artifacts somewhere. But no, we did our thing for a few years in San Francisco, put out a couple of EPs and toured a little bit, toured the country. It was awesome.
So you toured the country, though. So you were, I mean, somewhat, were you opening for other bands? Or had a van and you were...
We had a van. And I'm trying to remember which band we sold that van to, but it was like a much more like known band than us, but I just can't remember who it was.
Uh-huh.
But no, we had a van and we did our thing, and we would open for, you know, like kind of like cool, like West Coast, Pacific Northwest bands in San Francisco. It was a good time. And then it broke up. The guitarist, who is really just like a musical genius, he just kind of disbanded us. And so from there, like all of us kind of went on to our thing. I went on to play in other bands and kind of put my head down into other work. But that was a really formative experience to be living with three other people in an apartment in like the heart of the city, to be able to like have all of your music like stuff set up in the apartment. Everyone goes to work, comes back. The first thing you do is like plug in and just keep writing, keep recording, keep just playing. I don't know if I would live in that precise lifestyle at this time, but being 24 years old, that was a true gift. And economics are important. You know, I wasn't making very much money at that time because I was teaching at this this independent school in San Francisco, which was an awesome project. But because the market had buckled in 2000, 2001, rents all of a sudden became affordable. And I think I paid $600 a month, which was not nothing, but it's, you can get there.
2020, you know? In San Francisco. I mean, it's, yeah.
And that makes a difference on, you know, if the rent was $1,500 a month for being one person in a four bedroom, that I just would have had to like rethink my life or not live there, you know? And so I'm really grateful for that, having that space to do that creative experience and exploration, you know, in the city at that time. It was a gift.
Sure.
I was wondering about, I almost asked you this morning if you'd toured in bands before, because you're on a tour now, and just kind of, I think that's interesting whenever I talk to people who, you know, are coming, you know, maybe have always done both, have always played music, always written, but are on their first book tour after having done music tours, just kind of the strangeness of comparing the two, you know. But I mean, it's a completely different experience because you're touring alone right now, right?
I am so alone.
Yeah.
We're all so alone. Anyways.
But what kind of, I mean, are there ever any moments where you're like, this just would have been, I can't believe I'm calling this a tour as well, because this would have been so unimaginable on the other tours I've been on in my life.
This tour is more appropriate for my age level right now.
Good answer,
you know, it's just a little bit softer than being in the band.
How long is this tour? When did you start and when do you end?
I'm doing little mini tours. So that I'm doing a leg on the West Coast. It's a week long. I started in Southern California in Orange County area and just worked my way up the coast. And the end of last year, I did an East Coast tour. I'm going to go to the South in February and then sneaking in some other Midwest dates and some festival stuff throughout the spring. So
you're doing stuff though.
So, yeah, staying active. It's kind of like going to be maybe like a 6-7 month engagement of just trying to get out to communities, especially it's my first book. And there are just a lot of bookstores that are like, I don't know who this guy is. You know, there's a million books out there.
Right.
And so just to be able to go to bookstores, go to communities and just meet people and kick it with people is, it's important. Sure. I certainly from my publisher's perspective, they're like, yeah, you're doing promo. That's what you're supposed to do. But also I think just to like widen the literary community, you know, I've been invited into people's shows, into people's bookstores. And I want to let them know when I'm there, like, if you ever come to the Midwest, you are invited into our space, and just like increase that love and connection across the country.
Yeah. Which is a real kind of touring musician ethos, right? You know, I mean, it's something that maybe you don't see as much in the literary community, but it's so prevalent that just like, hey, we'll book a show for you if you come to our town, kind of thing. And so I actually kind of, I think that when I talk to people who have that kind of mindset about the literary world, I'm like, oh yeah, I mean, we should be doing this. That's how we should. And it happens, but it's just different because people are coming from such different worlds in the literary scene and not coming from DIY. A lot of people aren't coming from DIY. So it's like they don't kind of have that idea of exchange in the same way.
It's true. And some people are coming from DIY, but maybe they don't even know like to call it that, you know?
Right. Yeah.
You know, like they're all these lit journals are just folks just doing like a real like independent hustle.
Yeah. Right.
You know, a lot of these independent bookstores are doing like the independent hustle. A lot of the folks who are publishing books are like, you know, like really it's a, they're businesses and also labors of love, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, maybe it hasn't been cased or called the thing that it is, but right. But it is also DIY and it is very like independent culture, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is there ever too much of a good thing though? I mean, sometimes do you ever feel flooded by so much stuff that, I mean, it's hard to tease out what's what you like versus, or I mean, because you must get for, well, I don't, yeah, but for Mission Creek, you must get a lot of submissions, quote unquote, or you must get a lot of people. I mean, do you ever feel like sometimes we just need silence?
Say more.
Yeah.
Well, I feel overwhelmed often because I think people are doing good things. I mean, across mediums, music, literature, theater. But I'm only one person and it's hard. It's hard for me to sometimes tease out what should I put my interest and investment and engagement in versus what I shouldn't, because there's so much out there. And I think it's something where, you know, you go on Twitter, you go on Instagram, and I don't know. I mean, I'm a somewhat optimistic person in the sense that I think people are making amazing things all the time. You talk about Night People Records in here. Didn't know about it, looked it up, listened to some of the stuff in their SoundCloud. I thought it was all amazing. I thought it was really good. But for me, I get overwhelmed, I guess, by the amount of goodness, and it causes me, and maybe this is my own issue, it causes me to shrink away, you know, to just watch the old crap on TV or just to listen to, you know, I mean, I'm kind of overstating that, but do you ever deal with that? Or, I mean, are you more the opposite, that, I mean, there's not too much of a good thing, at least in terms of art, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if there's too much good stuff. I think we
are more discerning.
Yeah, I think we need that much, and I think it's good. Coming from the perspective of like a curator or a programmer or like a community engagement worker, particularly with Mission Creek Festival, we're just trying to create the space, right? And we are going to welcome as many people as we can like afford in the amount of time and the amount of slots that we have, whether they're writers or musicians. The way that we focus ourselves is really by saying this is about music and literature. We're obviously like super down with like other art and film and things like that. But I think by putting those like small constraints, it really like helps focus us from a programmatic viewpoint. And by having in our foundational documents that it's about independent voices, it like kind of brings it down even further. It's like there are already book festivals that exist that are going to get like super big authors to come in, so like that's not our thing, and that's not what we do, or at least big in terms of like massive book sales. And we're just about like who's out there trying to be an independent voice, and who's bringing just a wealth of like perspective, or how do we ensure that the whole program has a wealth of perspective on it? So I think we've got guidelines to help us kind of sift through, and there's some things that we don't book that we like really like. It's just like not particular to the mission of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's more from a programmatic side, but I think just from us as like citizens who are consuming culture and art, I think I'm like so busy that I actually don't even have enough time to consume everything. So I don't even have like the trouble of like, there's too much. I'm just like trying to keep up and like, damn, like my bookshelf is getting stacked and I haven't had a chance to even read.
Yeah. But does all that these... stress you out?
It doesn't stress me out. It's just more that I just need to take advantage of the time that I have off. Probably the practice I need to have is that, you know, I'll just like keep, it's just like work and like family. That's like all I do, which is great. That's a beautiful place to be. I probably need to make myself like just chill out a little bit more so that I'm enjoying those books. I've started getting better at my practice of going to see films and just like going alone, like during the day, just to see something and have that feeling of like just watching that piece of visual art and then seeing where that takes me after it. Just kind of taking myself out of the space, you know, of the regular race
and matinees work. Too. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
we're very lucky. We have an awesome movie theaters in Iowa City, downtown Iowa City.
Well, and there's a new one, right? Or it's a new, what's the, it's a nonprofit
Film Scene.
Film Scene.
Okay. Yeah. And it's, yeah, it's just three screens right downtown. I have four screens now right downtown. And it's really amazing curation. And you can kind of just walk in and just go see a movie. And sometimes it's great. Sometimes it's not. But like, they're all like well thought out.
Yeah. So this is, well, we'll say in a second. Pacify My Heart by Sasami. You brought her to Mission Creek?
No, Sasami has not been to Mission Creek, okay. Though we've done, we had a show with Sasami last summer, the summer of 2019, on the part of the tour for this record. I think she was on the road with Soccer Mommy and maybe had a day off or something like that. And came through Iowa City. Sasami is excellent. She's a great songwriter.
What do you like about, because you also have Sharon Van Etten, we asked you. I mean, what do you like about her specifically?
So,
and how were you introduced to her?
Okay. Here's what I like about Sasami. So Sasami is just, I really like the record that dropped, mm-hmm. you know, the self-titled record that came out last year. And I picked Pacify My Love because I really liked how it was evoking some sounds that I really identified with the Bay Area, Pacific Northwest from the early 2000s, where there was this kind of beautiful hangover from shoegaze, but also this like crossed over with like a dream pop or bedroom dream rock aesthetic, and just like fuzzy and warm, but also just aggressive as hell. And I like that she's unearthed that and re-envisioned it in her own voice. So for someone like me who's getting to middle age, I'm like, oh, like those were the jams, like, you know, I came up with. But also at the same time, but this is a new person who's like much younger than me, who's just like bringing her own style to it. Really reminded me of some just amazing bands that were around the area. I mean, not that it sounds exactly like them, but like evokes them, like the Eiler set, you know, bands like the Decoration, and then particularly like early to mid era school. There's this great record that Film School did called Always Never, which is an EP, four tracks, the classic lineup. And they were just kind of like the gods of San Francisco when that came out, and they would always be playing up and down the coast. Yeah, it was just like a real particular vibe, and like also like a touch of like Sparkle Horse and like early Granddaddy, just like somewhat cosmic, somewhat in the bedroom, very coastal or Central Valley, just like very Western and frontier, and like just all these things coming together, and then always just like that little shoegaze like dash in the background. I feel like that song, Pacify My Love, just like, or Pacify My Heart, get like just gets all those things like in one, you know, and it ends so aggressively,
sure,
just with like no regard, you know, and it's like kind of like a pissed off love song, just about being like, I don't know what it's about, but my interpretation is it's just like that people can like have this like power over your heart and then just kind of being like pissed at the end of it and just going into like a really like repetitive, aggressive, somewhat dissonant jam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. That might have been too much.
No. I mean, I guess I'm wondering, I mean, when you hear, do you listen for lyrics first or music? I guess it depends on the artist.
All over, you know, I love it all. And you know, I know we were sharing some track lists before the show, and in the track list that I shared, it was, I think, to show a range of, you know, how sound can take you places just purely on the sound and just the rhythm, but also just some songs where like, just like a lyrics play like a super key role in telling us something, you know?
Well, yeah, because you had Grateful Dead. I mean, we'll put this on the website. Sharon Van Etten, Mobb Deep, Kendrick Lamar. Am I missing Brittany Howard? That Brittany Howard song's great. That's her new album.
Yeah.
See, tomatoes are green and cotton is white. My heroes are black, so I got blue eyes.
I never got into Alabama Shakes. I actually listened to an interview with her recently. That's a really melodic, kind of soothing. Yeah, it's a great song.
Yeah. I love it. I love Brittany Howard, and I do like Alabama Shakes. They're like so popular that I'm just like, do I like this?
They
want
to. Yeah, they're really popular, right? I don't dislike them because they're popular. I just never gave them the time. I mean, I guess it goes back to, you know, like, do I have the energy to listen to this the way it maybe deserves to be listened to? I mean, I like that, like the single. I don't know. Like, yeah, they're good. Yeah.
I think I loved them from the second they came out. They are so. I was surprised that I liked a band that was so popular. Not because I was like you, not because I was mad at them for being popular. But I was just surprised that that's where my taste like aligned, because they don't always do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're just like really well considered. They do stuff that I think is immediately catchy and stuff that's just weird. Their second record was just so like they just went their own way, and it was still like poppy, but also just like they were in the zone. And I feel this record that she's done as a solo piece has just allowed her to like explore even other textures that she hasn't gotten to yet. Mm-hmm. Maybe freed a little bit from like that, you know, there was kind of like a downhill. I mean, they're from like Alabama, like coming out of that scene, like, you know,
rock band. Yeah.
You're going to just get a little bit of that vibe. I think was attracted to it because, you know, it came out of that scene that to some degree, I think had spawned Drive-By Truckers and then Jason Isbell. Mm-hmm. And it was like cool to get like a different sound or voice out of that same kind of creative well,
mm-hmm.
you know? So I respect that as a counterpoint to like maybe how Patterson Hood or Jason Isbell or even Amanda Shires might write songs. It's like you also have this new voice, Brittany and her band and her on her own, just like bringing to just like diversifying, like straight up diversifying, because mm-hmm. she's black and all those other people are white, or she's mixed race. But also diversifying, just like, these are the kinds of textures that can come out of like the Deep South. Yeah. You know, it's helping them not get pigeonholed. Even though all the people I mentioned before are like extremely creative and have all done like mega dope work.
Should we play another song?
Sure. That was an interesting, I think, for me, because I really like Sharon Van Etten, but that was her second album. I don't know. She's great. She's kind of changed her sound. But her, I think it was her third or does she have five albums now? I think she has at least four. But she's gotten into a bigger kind of, she's a bigger act. And what about that album Epic, like, really kind of hit you?
Yeah. I think I see it the same way. Sharon Van Etten has really changed as to write, and that's what she should be doing if that's what she wants to do. Changed so much that I think she's maybe gone through like three or four permutations mm-hmm. of her voice and her sound and how she wants to present art to the world, which is pretty awesome. And I really like the album that just came out last year that was bumping on the single. I think 19 was a single they put, like, I was like, all right, like, cool, like, you're in a different vibe. And I think that was like the strongest work she had put out for a really long time. So all that to say is that I went back to Peace Signs and A Crime off the album Epic, because I thought that record was such a singular representation of kind of like folk-ish songwriter vibe that maybe we don't hear as much today, but she really accomplished something just sonically and I think lyrically in a way, while also being pretty minimal in terms of the instrumentation that she was bringing to it. But it's a really just like thick and beautiful record. Only, I think, like seven songs, which I love. It's just like, they're not just giving us too much. Mm-hmm. You know, she just comes correct, which is like every song is awesome. And it's like immediate as well as like ambient throughout the record. And I remember seeing her on the tour. It was either right when that album came out or right before it was going to come out. And she was opening for Bowerbirds on mm-hmm. tour. And she was just playing solo. She didn't even have a band yet. And she played, I think, I heard Peace Signs and A Crime, that first tour she did with them. And it was just like so powerful. Just her. Just crushing it out. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful record. And I'll say it more succinctly. I think I just didn't want us to forget that she made this amazing music while like continuing to make amazing music. That's just kind of on a different, you know, vibe.
You feel like it's maybe a little buried in her discography at this point?
Yes, because, you know, sometimes these artists get more popular as they go on. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's like the fourth album that like brings someone in, and they don't have time to really go back to the discog or go through the archives. Right. Or maybe they do. But I say that because I remember once a buddy of mine, he heard, I think, the single Red Eyes from maybe the third or fourth War on Drugs record. Mm-hmm. And then he was listening to that record and he was like, I love the War on Drugs. And he was a music promoter and like he had them playing or whatever. And he's like, this band's so awesome. And I was like, yeah, it's like Slave Ambient. And like, I was driving across the country and I used to listen to that record all the time. I drove across the country. He's like, what's Slave Ambient? And it was like the record like before that. And I was like, oh shit. Like, you don't even like your mind's about to be expanded. Or maybe not. Maybe he finally listens to Slave Army and he's like, that's basic. Like, that's rudimentary. Like, I want this, like, further, like, developed version of War on Drugs. But to me, that's my favorite record they did. And it just, like, that moment, I was like, oh, sometimes artists are all over the place, and sometimes we might just get one record and not fully understand their scope, which is okay, right. But it's just interesting.
And love that record and, like, claim the band in some way without seeing the whole picture.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I was really curious about The Dead, because The Dead comes up, I think, twice in the book, very briefly. And then it was on the playlist, too, and I was like, oh, he really does like The Dead. What? Because there's, I think it's the essay written in the third person where yes. you're like, he loves the dead but hates hippies. You know, it just, so what, yeah. What's your relationship with the Grateful Dead?
I think the Grateful Dead is one of the quintessential American bands. Their dedication to capturing tales and stories of just maybe underground America, or as some would call it, old weird America, being this bridge between Kerouac, Neil Cassidy, and what would become the 60s and the 70s and the era that created the boomers. I think they're just like, they're just great, like, storytellers, you know, of that work. I know that they're super lumped in with the whole movement of jam bands, because I mean, yeah, they were the prototype for that. But I think what gets forgotten is that they were, at least for, you know, a good period, like, extremely, like, serious. I mean, they're always serious songwriters, but they were, like, writing songs, you know, above and beyond.
Working just Man's Dead. Yeah. American Beauty. Like, yeah. I guess I don't listen to every Dick's Picks, you know, or whatever. Right. Those early albums, I mean, you put one from Working Man's Dead on there that, you know, yeah, that's an amazing song. And I think it's, what, 4 minutes long, 3 minutes long? Yeah. Cumberland Blues.
And I'm, like, way into the improvisational side of them and just, like, that bravery, which took many forms from the 60s until they went into what I think we kind of became aware of as, like, dead culture, like, maybe in the 80s or 90s. I'm way into that, but also, like, they wrote, like, some, like, key American tracks. Mm-hmm. And I picked Cumberland Blues because it's the story of just, you know, this guy working in the coal mine. And it, like, starts off, like, very just him, you know, like, almost like kind of like a jagged, like, love song and just, like, having to get to work, but having this, like, you know, just being, you know, he's like, you know, he's talking to his girlfriend. He's like, you know, you kept me up to, like, four or whatever, and I got to go to work, like, in 10 minutes or whatever. But then, like, at the very end, it's just like working in the system as, like, an American is, like, totally killing the average American worker. Like, goes, like, so deep so quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, so sad. And the reason it, like, breaks my heart is because you listen to it and you're like, oh, damn, like, nothing has changed. Like, they, like, wrote this as, like, a folk song, probably, like, harkening back to, like, like, the 1930s, right? You know, they're, like, pulling it up from, like, this, like, inspiration from, like, 50 years before or 30 or 40 years before their time. And we're, like, still here in 2020 and, like, they're still in the coal mines. Like, you know, like, you know, like, 100 years later. And if it's not the coal mines, there's, like, something else that is very similar to the coal mine. It's just, like, it's, like, such a sad song. But it's also beautiful because, like, because they really do capture. It's, like, so hard. You're just working so hard to just kind of survive. And if you had, like, I can't remember the lyrics, but if you just, like, had, like, a few more dollars, you would, like, leave and go to the next thing. But you can never just get a few more dollars. And I think, like, that reflection on American life for many folks in America just, like, rings so true still.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've never thought about it in that much detail. That's interesting, yeah.
I am so sold on The Dead right now. Yeah. Actually, we record here at KBOO Studios in Portland, and there's been a show, I think, on KBOO for years that's all Grateful Dead. And it's just a guy who just, you know, I imagine an old hippie guy who's just, like, has all the bootlegs and all the things. And I think it's, like, this 2-hour-long show, you know, it's just, like, and sometimes I'll be listening to KBOO and I'll be like, wow, what is this? And then I'll come on and, oh, I was like, oh, that's the Dead. Sometimes it's this, I think it's like modern ambient, you know, artist or something, like a soundscape artist. And I'll be like, oh, that was the Dead. Okay. You know, and so I have been really surprised because I used to be someone who was like, no, that's not for me. And then I've heard all these things in the last 5 or 10 years that have really kind of caught me off guard and made me reconsider. So,
yeah, they've got a lot of different modes.
Yeah.
They got some good years. They also have some bad years. Yeah. But I think if you're like a band for 30 years, like,
that's it's inevitable. Just gonna,
like, it's going to get whack at some point. Yeah, like, you can't fight it.
Yeah. Just to end, now, I mean, I guess I'm just curious about your expectations as a writer. I mean, I assume this is your first book. I assume you saw a lot of other people in your community publish books while you were working on this. I mean, do you see yourself being someone who wants to put out a book every like 3 years? Or, I mean, this is a very focused, taught book. I mean, it's talking about different things. It's obviously kind of focused on yourself mostly, but I guess I'm just going back to kind of that content. I mean, do you think I'm going to put out another book in 2 years? Or, I mean, is this something that, you know, you feel content with for now, and then you're going to go someplace else, but it might be 6 years before you go there?
Definitely already working on the next thing, whatever it is.
Okay.
And I'd say it's so abstractly, because I think it's still finding its space, and it might be another 6 or 7, 8 months before I really get the focus. So just writing a lot, taking a lot of notes, especially while I'm on the road for these next few months. So yeah, already working on the next thing. In terms of timetable, I'm a really slow writer at this stage in my life, and so things just kind of develop very, very, very slowly and take a lot of time for me to reflect on and figure out what is the right form to be telling these stories or to share these philosophies on the world. So maybe it happens in a few years, maybe it happens longer than that, I don't know. One good thing about age is, like, I think I'm just like, just keep doing the work, and and when it's done, it's done, and let's not try to stress it out. I think that's probably why I work on a bunch of projects. So, like, something's always, like, kind of coming to completion, whether it's something I'm doing in service to other artists, like a festival.
Sure. So it's not only you alone in a room writing. You're always, in a way, making things or working on things. It's just not only,
keeps me healthy.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
You know? I'll get back to playing music when we're done with the tour.
You still have a guitar or all
else? Yeah.
Oh, so it's still part of your life to a degree.
Yeah, and it's the expectations are just to, like, keep writing songs. And songs, you know, you can just come out, like, a little bit quicker than an essay or a short story or, you know, a series of poems. It's just the payoff is a little bit quicker, which is just nice. And you also have both the beauty and the tension of, like, collaborating with someone else. I mean, you don't have to, but for me, that's, like, kind of the beauty of it, is just to be like, here are some ideas. What happens when we put our ideas together and kind of figure out the Venn diagram? And maybe that Venn diagram could or couldn't be, like, a good song.
Yeah. Do you have a project or band that you're working on?
Yes. I got a long-term project. It's called Lonely Hearts. Mm-hmm. And I formed it with this guy, John Lindenbaum, who now lives in Fort Collins, but we met in the Bay Area, and he's in this absolutely amazing project called Nada Lands, which is, I think, kind of his, like, main thing now. And yeah, just go check out Nada Lands. Side note. Right, they're so weird and awesome. But we've been doing Lonely Hearts for, you know, like 15, 16 years in a really quiet, like, methodical way, because we've mostly lived in different places, and so we'll just, like, write from a distance and then write together, and it's like lifelong project of just thinking about, of just, like, our dual exploration of what does this song mean in the modern era. I describe it as a post-apocalyptic folk band, you know, talking about current situations or situations that are within reach and not pretty.
Yeah.
Do you you have recordings out there? You have albums out?
Yeah. We've got I can't even remember, but we maybe done like 3 records.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Most of them have been on like super small labels, like super like micro indie labels, and we're, I think, in the works on a fifth record, and as things quiet down on the book front, I think attentions and priorities will turn to just trying to let us tease out the final ideas on that record. He just finished a Nautilans record, so I think he's like now, like, okay, like I can start thinking about some Lonely Hearts stuff.
Nice. We'll put some Lonely Hearts and Nautilans stuff on the playlist for the show, perhaps on the website. So
yeah,
get it out there a little bit.
It's
a little
highly
bit.
Ambivalent.
I love it. I mean, for me, it's been a great project. I mean, I feel proud of some of the music. We've been really lucky in touring. We've done everything from like super DIY, like, you know, living room shows to like the standard clubs to like the nice theater here and there. So
nice.
I love driving around America, you know, mm-hmm. and just like getting to know more about all the like thousands of communities that actually make up who we are, and mm-hmm. not just getting caught up in my little, you know, oasis or like little cocoon in Iowa City or wherever I'm living.
Right. And the imagined perspective of what different places around the country are like versus the reality of them.
Yes. And I think that's, I mean, not to circle too much around the Grateful Dead, but I think they, with other bands, like represented that. They were very much like, we're trying to get these scraps of America so we can understand what the hell America is.
Right.
You know, yeah. And I think that's like that's a really good project.
Yeah.
Because so many of us are just like so turned up about like our political beliefs and mm-hmm. our philosophies. And I think we'd all be like a little bit more mellow if we fully understood all of the communities and what they look like and what they're experiencing across the country. Doesn't mean we agree on everything. And it doesn't mean that there aren't like major lifetime issues and tensions that we need to figure out in this country. Mm-hmm. But I think us being more aligned to everyone else's experiences would make it easier to do the collaboration and get things done.
Yeah. And next you go to Seattle. So you're making your silhouette. All right. Andre Perry, thank you so much.
Thank you guys. I'm so honored to be able to kick it with y'all while coming through Portland and just talk about books and music. I mean, like, could do this for 2 days.
Oh, we could go on for a really long time. Yeah.
Thanks, Andre.
Thank you.
Steer is recorded at KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. It's broadcast through Dublab Radio, KZUT in Los Angeles, and can be found anywhere you listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us.